Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If democracy is the heart of America, and the heart of democracy is voting, it's time for a serious checkup. Aggressive redistricting, antiquated voting machines, long lines at some polls, and an expiring Voting Rights Act have critics asking what's going on with the quality of the American vote. Are voters choosing politicians, or are politicians choosing voters, with districts gerrymandered like creatures out of Dr. Seuss? The Supreme Court has now stepped in with a thumbs up for partisan redistricting in Texas. Congress is about to join the fray. From Arnold Schwarzenegger to the League of Women Voters, word is we've got a problem on our hands. Up next on Point, the quality of the American vote on trial. We turn first today to Washington, where Congress has been debating renewal of the Voting Rights Act, just one piece of the voting system. Chuck Babington covers Congress, Charles Babington, for the Washington Post. Chuck Babington, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
Tell us what's going on here. This is a 40-year-old legislation. Some Southerners are saying, do we still need this in 2006? What's the shape of the debate in Congress?
Well, it came up as a surprise, Tom. The key provisions of the act will expire next year if they're not reauthorized. Everybody thought reauthorizing would probably be a pretty easy deal because you had both Republican and Democratic leaders of both the House and Senate signing off on it. But then a couple of weeks ago, the Republicans in the House were surprised by some resistance, more resistance than they had expected, from really two quarters, from a number of Southerners, mainly Georgia and Texas, who felt that their states should be allowed to get out from under some of the provisions. And that group was joined by other Republicans from various states that said they didn't like a provision that requires bilingual ballots in many provisions. And that combined opposition caught the leadership by surprise. They had to pull the reauthorization off the floor. Now they're hoping they can get their ducks in a row and do it on Thursday.
Chuck Babington, does the whole act expire next year, or specific provisions?
Specific provisions, but I think they're some of the most important provisions, ones that go back to, you know, sort of the origins of the act back in 1965, where there were, you know, there were a number of impediments to voting by minorities, you know, the poll tax, literacy tests, that sort of thing. Those are gone, but there are other, all kinds of, you know, things, large and small, that some people say might have the impact of diminishing voter turnout. And so now the states and counties that are covered by it, even little things like changing a voting place from the Methodist Church to the Baptist Church across the street, would have to be approved by the Justice Department. And those are the kind of things that some of the Southern Republicans feel they really shouldn't have to go through that type of hoops anymore.
Southern voting places specifically targeted in this act. And then there's the bilingual issue. Has that gotten mixed up with the immigration debate?
That's right, Tom. It's a good point. Some people say, look, these are two totally different things, but because of the fervor over the immigration debate, they very much have kind of gotten conflated in the minds of many people. And then there's this sort of movement, and very generally speaking, sort of the English-only movement, that people who feel like, you know, all official business of the United States ought to be conducted in English, and therefore those adherents to that belief are unhappy by these provisions that require ballots or interpreters to be provided in places where census findings indicate that there are a need for help with English on ballot initiatives and that sort of thing.
The Supreme Court ruling very recently, of course, on the Texas redistricting, the controversial, rather partisan redistricting that Tom DeLay led there. Now this Voting Rights Act debate on the floor of Congress. Do you hear concern in Congress about the quality of the electoral system that Americans are looking at, or are these incumbents who sort of like things the way they are, Chuck?
Well, one thing you got to remember about any incumbent is that he or she got elected under the system that exists, and therefore there's just a natural bias, to be wary about changing anything. That said, I do think the concerns about the electoral system, probably the ones you hear the most about, are still stemming from the 2000 situation in Florida that I think really pulled back the curtain on how problematic some of the ballots are and just some of the, you know, how county by county the whole system is. I would say those concerns probably outweigh some of the others that we've been talking about.
Mm. Chuck Babington, congressional reporter for the Washington Post. He spoke to us from Washington. Chuck, thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to do it, Tom.
Joining us now now from Washington is voting rights advocate Spencer Overton. He's professor of law at George Washington University's School of Law and author of the stinging new book, Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. Spencer Overton, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Jack, good to have you along.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Overton.
Spencer Overton, you've got a very thoroughgoing critique here in this book. You describe the American sort of voting system, electoral system, as in big, big trouble. Well, give us your big picture.
Tom, politicians control America by manipulating election rules. We talk a great game about exporting democracy to other nations, but in fact, here in the United States, the people are not in control. Politicians use redistricting, antiquated voting machines, long lines, and other barriers to voting to determine who votes and whose vote counts. Voters don't choose politicians, but in fact, politicians choose voters by manipulating election rules.
You start this book with a pretty vivid analogy between the situation of American voters and specifically the movie The Matrix, where people live
right.
as kind of unknowing, you know, creatures of a greater power. Are you really suggesting there's some kind of giant conspiracy here, or is this just an accretion of problems in our voting system that's built up over decades?
Well, I don't think that there is one, you know, person in control. I don't think that there's one political operative like James Carville or Karl Rove in control of everything. And so that's not what exists. Instead, there are a variety of actors, political actors, who have a large degree of influence, and they actually make decisions that favor themselves. So the analogy to the movie The Matrix is essentially that most Americans think that people control our nation through votes, but in reality, politicians shape our nation and the policies that we have through this matrix of technical election rules, and this matrix essentially determines political outcomes and shapes government policies. And so that is the analogy to the matrix.
Take us down through your checklist. You open the book quoting George Orwell in 1984, saying, "In the end, the party would announce that 2 and 2 made 5, and you would have to believe it." When it comes to American voting, how do you see that dynamic at work? What's your case?
Well, I think that we, you know, things seem as though, you know, it's fair. This is a great democracy. We are the home of the brave and the land of the free. But in reality, incumbents, people who are in power, manipulate rules. If we were to just look in the partisan gerrymandering context, let's just take, for example, let's say I am a Democratic incumbent and I narrowly lost my last election, or won my last election, rather, with 51% of the vote. That was too close for me. So what I do is I change the shape of my district, remove some Republican precincts, and I add some Democratic precincts, and in the next election, I win with 65% of the vote, not because I'm a better representative or more responsive to the people, but because I've shuffled the voters. And both Democrats and Republicans do this across the country. As you probably know, in 2004, Congress had only a 40% approval rating, and yet 98% of incumbents won. This is a problem across the country. In 36 states, basically, politicians redistrict, draw their own districts. We've got this massive situation of the fox guarding the hen house across the country, both with regard to redistricting as well as administration of elections. Other countries around the world have independent officials that administer election. Even Iraq, the democracy that we helped set up, has an independent commission that administers elections. Here in the United States, partisans administer the elections. For example, in Florida, as you probably know, Catherine Harris was the chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign. And so we've got a situation where the umpire is playing for one particular team, and it's a massive conflict of interest.
Take us on down through your checklist. Redistricting looms very large, and of course we're all aware of that. It only seems to grow more favorable toward incumbents. You've got administrative issues. What other dynamics do you see in play here?
Well, you know, your right to vote in this country depends on where you live. We've got 4,600 different election systems in this country with massive inequalities in terms of funding and access to the ballot. In Columbus, Ohio, for example, Tom, officials knew they needed 5,000 voting machines. They decided to make do with only 3,000 machines, and they moved machines from urban areas out into suburban areas.
You're talking 2004 presidential election?
This is in the 2004 presidential election. As a result, Tanya Thivner, she waited 4 hours to vote in line in Columbus proper, but her mother out in a suburb waited only 15 minutes. And voters are treated like cattle. Dorothy Turner, for example, in Ohio, an 80-year-old woman, she waited 2.5 hours standing in line. Her back hurt. No one offered her a chair. She said she stood in line because she didn't know. Mrs. Turner said she didn't know if she would be around to vote in the next presidential election. Tom, Starbucks and McDonald's do not make people wait 2.5 hours in line. If they did, they'd go out of business. Voting is at least as important as a cup of Frappuccino or a quarter pounder. We really can do better, and we need to do much better.
Jack Beatty, we need to give Americans a chance for a fair and square vote as easy as they can order a cup of coffee. How close are we to that?
We're far away from it. Consider this, that in 2002, 15 of the 435 House races were rated toss-ups, only 15. Mm. But in the state of Iowa, 4 of the 5 races for Congress were rated highly competitive. Now, why? What made the difference? Well, in Iowa, the congressional boundaries are drawn by nonpartisan officials. They're instructed to disregard incumbent and other political preferences. Their plan has to go to the legislature, and the legislature has turned down some of the plans of this commission. But you can't argue with the results. 4 or 5 highly competitive races in one state versus only 15 in the entire 435 competitive across the country.
That's a big difference. Applause to Iowa there. Spencer Overton, speak to the significance of this. I mean, we get a sense that, yes, there may be problems, but no system's perfect, and these are things at the margin, and, you know, there'll always be some margin of problem. We can live with this. You clearly don't see it that way. Why?
No, I don't see it that way. It's because we fall beneath international democratic standards. As I mentioned, in other parts of the world, incumbents don't draw their own districts. Incumbents don't administer elections and end up favoring themselves. So there are a variety of areas in which we fall between international norms, and I think that we can do much better. We don't spend enough and we don't focus enough of our resources on promoting democracy here in the United States.
So are some policies being advantaged by this? Do you see a political tilt to right. the ultimate outcome of these problems in the voting system, or is it just a kind of a, you know, random spray skew of what, right. what Americans would vote for if everybody was cleanly, fairly, easily in there?
Tom, I think that there are certainly political consequences. I mean, if we look, for example, at the 2000 election where George Bush won by 537 votes, there are a variety of anti-democratic rules in Florida, such as a rule that prevents people who have served their time from voting for life. That rule
You're talking
is in place
former prisoners.
That's absolutely right. So people who have served their time, paid their debt to society, preventing those people from voting for life. Now, the only places that have that rule would be Florida, Virginia, Kentucky, and Armenia. Those are the only democracies in the world that prohibit all people who have served their time from voting. And so that's the kind of thing that can have consequences. However, Tom, the most important thing here is to not get caught up with political elites and not sound like sour grapes. This is a problem that insults voters and the will and the choice of voters. This isn't about political elites. It's not about sour grapes in terms of losing an election. It's not about policies and or issues. Certainly there are consequences, but to the extent we focus on that, it becomes some political partisan debate, and this adversely impacts all people of all political backgrounds. I'll give you one example. In Louisiana, there was a candidate, Bobby Jindal, conservative Republican.
Right.
He was Asian American, and as a result, many Republicans abandoned him. And he lost. And these Republicans were from areas where former KKK member David Duke won in the past. So these former KKK members abandoned Bobby Jindal in the election. And as a result, the white Democrat won the election there in Louisiana. And this was only a couple of years ago. So the point is that these problems are not just Republican problems or Democratic problems. They're really problems that impact us all.
Jack Beatty, I don't think any Americans are comfortable with this idea that we may not be getting the full will of the American people reflected in the polls. I mean, we rely on that over time to give us strength and to give us stability. But there's such a complicated matrix, to use Spencer's word, of elements at play here that it's kind of hard to know where to aim one's fire when you feel uneasy about it.
It is, and I am of the opinion that redistricting is a big problem. However, that's been what I've been saying on this show for 5 years. Mm-hmm. However, I read a piece in the Harvard Law Review that has me asking questions about it. In fact, it was called In Defense of Foxes Guarding Hen Houses. And this fellow points out some things that I hadn't lit on that makes me think that maybe at least redistricting isn't the problem with incumbency protection that we think it is. For example, the House incumbency reelection rate between 1990 and 2000 was 95.2. The Senate reelection rate was 89.8, a difference, but not a significant difference. And, of course, the Senate is not redistricted. It is mm-hmm. just one open
right.
race. So if redistricting is the problem with incumbency protection, why doesn't, you know, well, how do we explain this variance? Secondly, there is this strange thing. People in general say they don't like Congress, but they like their representative. Over 20 years, for example, 46% of the people said from 1980 to 2000, no, we don't like Congress. But only 10% of them said they didn't like their own representative.
Right.
So, you know, you actually have one of the factors that makes for that is clearly they like what the person is doing. And then you ask yourself the question, well, what would it be like if we had really competitive, in other words, if an independent commission with no political ties at all, and that's mm-hmm. hard to imagine, mm-hmm. were to put together districts that were absolutely competitive, 49-49, what would result? Well, this fellow makes a point in the Harvard Law Review. He said, well, suppose there was a presidential election where swing to one candidate, he wins by 5% of the vote, and he takes those congressional districts with him because there's a coattail effect.
Yep.
Well, then you've got 49% of the people in those districts who are unrepresented in that election because the tide of this, you know, coattails in a balanced district was such as to almost deprive them of a political voice.
So he says stack the vote so people do get their will.
Well, yes, and also there's a strange way in which even highly gerrymandered districts preserve political diversity, strangely enough.
I hear that. Spencer Overton, what do you make of it? If redistricting right. is so evil, mm-hmm. why is the Senate almost as friendly to incumbents as the House? The Senate, of course, is right. just two per state. There's no mm-hmm. redistricting that.
Well, Tom, I'd point out that this is a matrix, so there's not one silver bullet here. We need to look at all of these things together in terms of redistricting and rules in terms of determining turnout. So there's not one silver bullet here. That's number one. Number two, I am familiar with Nate Persily's article in the Harvard Law Review. Mm. Nate's a friend, and I disagree with it for a couple reasons. Number one, hey, if I put all my friends in my district, you know, everyone in my district is going to like me. That's not a surprise to anyone. Mm-hmm. Second point here is that I would agree with Nate that districts that are 50-50 aren't necessarily great things and aren't necessarily representative. The objective here is not necessarily to have all districts that are 50-50 or only focus on competition as a norm.
So what would the criteria be for a well-districted right. map?
Well, I think there are two different questions, right? One is a conflict of interest question. Who should be doing this, right? And I think that we want to take the power out of the hands of incumbents because they have this conflict of interest. It's like if you were to have a jury and the jury is stacked completely with people from the prosecutor's office or from the defense counsel's office. You don't want to do that. And so I think, number one, we want to have the conflict of interest off the table. Number two, I think we do want to look at, in terms of variables and values, communities of interest, I think are certainly important, ensuring that the community as a whole, the state as a whole, is well represented, and that there is some political diversity. So I would agree with those values. My biggest problem here is this conflict of interest and the self-interest of incumbents calling the shots.
Lots of issues here and a lot of unease about the square, the plum quality of American voting. I want to turn to our listeners. Patrick is on the line from East Lansing, Michigan. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I shared an office with Tom Downs, the DNC's lead recount lawyer who got Senator Magnuson elected after a long recount to the U.S. Senate.
Right.
And I was thinking about recounts for about 8 years before we got to 2000, and I stood back and watched that election, and the Supreme Court stopped a fair recount process, and Jamie Raskin, in his book Overruling Democracy, really covers how they said you don't have a constitutional right to vote for president. And I found it so shocking, the silence following that in the Democratic Party. And I think Robert Kennedy Jr. picked that up in the Rolling Stone article that came out 2 weeks ago, where he asked the simple question about recounts, and he asked, how can we make them fair? And I just have two things to say, and I'm really interested in your guest's ideal recount procedure, because I just believe the devil's in the details.
Mm-hmm.
I do banking law. And I know the law requires that I get a receipt when I put $100 in cash in the machine.
Yep.
And if it didn't give me a receipt, I would know the industry would end up on the upside with a lot of unaccounted money.
Sure.
But in the vote for president, you don't get a receipt. And the machines aren't required to give you one because President Bush didn't convene the commission to adopt the standard because he didn't fund the commission.
You're talking about a receipt for the poll watchers at each poll.
The voter being given a printed receipt to verify the ballot and assure its accuracy.
But what would the advantage? You're going to reassemble all those voters, ask them all to turn in their receipts and count them? Is that what you're saying?
It means that if there's a paper receipt and a paper record, they can't reprogram and shift tens of thousands of votes to steal the election.
Mm-hmm.
And you can recount it, and you can make it fair. In Canada, they bring every ballot by truck with armed guards to one place. They hand count them, and in 48 hours, a hand count produces a result. They do it in Mexico. And that's my first point. My second point is equally quick. Greg Palast, in his book, makes clear that 78,000 felons serving their time, convictions out of Florida, had an absolute right to vote for Al Gore or George Bush, that they would have voted 92% for Gore or higher. But the Court of Appeals in Florida ruled that they were improperly removed, and yet they showed up and they were sent away because the administration, Kathleen Harris, took them off the rolls illegally in violation of the court's order, and that turned the election, and there was no recount procedure to rectify that. And our provisional ballot law, which seeks to do so, is powerless if once you do have a record of people turned away, you don't have a way to count it.
Patrick, we hear how informed you are and how passionate about this. Let me give it to Spencer Overton. Spencer, there are some big ones, and you know, I think what Patrick captures there is our kind of fear that when the elections come, especially presidential elections, they come on with such fury and such high stakes that in the heat of the moment, it's hard to feel assured that you've got sort of equanimity in how all this turns out. Certainly in 2000, people were left completely flummoxed on many fronts. What about when it's that close and you've got recount issues like that? How do you see it?
Well, a couple points. Number one, a concern that people have articulated about a receipt that you can take with you is that might lead to vote buying. In other words, if someone knows how I voted and I can prove that with a receipt that I give to them, then they can tell me, hey, Spencer, I'll give you $50.
But what about some kind of paper trail?
Okay. And I'm moving there, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there's value in a process where you maybe vote electronically, there's a printout that you can review and look at, and then you submit that printout, and that printout is actually what is counted, not unlike a Scantron that's counted, that's used for, tests that we take in school. So I do think that there's value in terms of paper. However, I don't think that's enough. You know, paper can be manipulated as well. And I think that the real key here is to, in addition to having paper, having some audit procedures. We put a lot of scrutiny in terms of preventing fraud on average voters who are just trying to participate. The real scrutiny in terms of preventing fraud needs to be on machine manufacturers, on the people who administer elections. These people are often partisans. They control thousands of votes, and that's where our auditing needs to be. The scrutiny needs to be. We audit major corporations to protect shareholders. We should audit election officials and machine companies in order to protect voters. One other quick point is your guest brought up, your caller brought up this notion of the lack of a constitutional amendment or constitutional provision in terms of the right to vote. And that's the big picture question. We can get down here in the weeds and talk about technical solutions. But the real question here is, will politicians maintain control? Will courts step up to the plate and really enshrine and protect the right to vote as a constitutional right, not unlike the right to free speech?
Don't we have that right already? Are you saying we need an amendment to assure that right? Isn't that fundamental?
Well, some people, such as Professor Raskin, suggest that we do need that amendment, and that is a contested question because some courts have said that we do have that fundamental right to vote, and others have said that we don't. And so that really is a contested question. As you know, with a right like speech, you know, a local government can't just purge you and say you can't speak. But that's the situation with the right to vote or with voting, because your right to vote often depends on where you live and the decisions of local bureaucrats and local politicians. And so the question here is, how do we enshrine that and protect it in a larger way? And that's a big kind of philosophical question as well.
Jack, you can hear in Patrick's call from East Lansing, I mean, he is clued in and he clearly feels utterly uneasy about how outcomes finally get determined when they're close and what comes into play. That's not the way Americans ought to feel when they go to the ballot to cast ballots on voting day.
No, and as I'm sure Spencer can tell us, you know, we've had that experience in 2000, and presumably we set out to remedy it, and yet everything I read about voting machines, mistakes in counts, and so on, and to say nothing of people like the Secretary of State of Ohio, Kenneth Blackwell, who's running for governor, who's in charge of the voting system. Well, of course, in 2004, he did everything but practically. He was even getting down to the paper, the paper that people were sending in on petitions and on registrations. It wasn't the right kind of paper. He was doing whatever he could to drive down turnout. That has to bother everybody, that an elected official with a deep stake in this is handling the administration. We haven't done anything about that. We haven't done anything about the machines that I know of, about these receipts. In fact, they've been avoided. So it's as if Americans really aren't all that steamed about it. And I think there's collusion here. I really think that the incumbents, we're talking about one party, the incumbent party. And right. I think the incumbent party really doesn't want to shake things up too badly.
When you say, Republican or Democrat, just incumbency with capital
right.
I.
I'm in, and I got in by these rules. And by God, if they start tinkering with them, with redistricting, with issues of, you know, vote, whatever it might be, I could lose. So, you know, hence from the Democrats after 2000, where was the outrage? I didn't see it. I mean, people say, well, President Bush has won, and let's go on. Well, there were all sorts of things to be outraged about. They didn't do it.
I want to turn to Pasadena, California now for a moment. Jonathan Katz joins us. He's professor of political science at the California Institute of Technology. He's a member of the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project, which has evaluated the state of the American voting system since the 2000 election. He's paid a lot of attention to gerrymandering and redistricting and all the rest. Author of Elbridge Gerry's Salamander, The Electoral Consequences of the Reapportionment Revolution. Jonathan Katz, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
First, to California. It's a very interesting example. Arnold Schwarzenegger said, enough with all this political redistricting. I want to, as, at least as I understood this from afar, Jonathan, he said, I want to get this in the hands of an independent commission. California turned that down. Why? What's gone on there?
Well, I think voters were a bit confused by the initiative, and they were also pretty unhappy with the governor. So he had put a number of measures on the ballot in a special election, and his popularity wasn't too high, and there was lots of campaigning, not so much against that measure, but against his other measures regarding changes in budget policy and the like. And the few who made it to the polls voted no across the board against the governor.
So Iowa may have got it right, but what did you learn from that effort in California to pull this out of the political arena? about how a national effort to do that, or you know, a broader effort across more states might shape up. I mean, can voters somehow be led to the polls to vote this out of the hands of politicians? And is there a better place for it?
Well, they have in some states. For example, Arizona, by a state constitutional referendum, in fact, moved to an independent redistricting commission for the last round of elections. I forgot when their vote was. It was before 2000. So it's a difficult thing. Redistricting is not an exciting topic for most voters. And so, and you're putting before a measure that says, you know, how should we, what should be the intricacies of not just should it be an independent commission, but what should the criteria be for drawing districts?
And what is the sort of golden criteria? Is there some set that everybody agrees on? If politicians weren't doing it, if some kind of, you know, somehow it was the hand of God drawing districts, what would the criteria be?
Well, that's the problem. There are lots of criteria. The standards in the U.S. case tend to be contiguity, that is, our district should be sort of continuous,
right.
Compactness, they should look like normal shapes, circles and squares. But then you get to these other ones. They should be in compliance with the Voting Rights Act. They should be, Professor Overton said, they should maybe respect communities of interest. And then there's the big one we've been talking about, which is competitiveness. The problem is that, for example, the Arizona constitutional amendment actually listed those sets of criteria. And the problem is that they don't tell you how to adjudicate between them. What do you do when drawing a competitive district goes at odds with keeping, communities of interest? For example, drawing a district in Southern California, if you draw it in Orange County, it's very difficult to draw a competitive district. It's an overwhelmingly Republican area.
Spencer, of course, the Supreme Court got involved here just a couple of weeks ago with the Texas redistricting that Tom DeLay led not long ago, and said, you know what, it was controversial. Yes, it was partisan, but that's been done before, and it was okay.
Right. That is absolutely correct. And the court, I think, did put a stamp of approval on manipulation. Unfortunately, voters can't hold politicians accountable when they're splitting up communities and undermining representation. There are a couple of problems with the court's decision. To a certain extent, it opens the floodgates to manipulation. We could see political payback by Democrats in states like Illinois, New Mexico, and Louisiana, where Democrats control the government. And also, Tom, if your poll numbers are down just before an election, why not redraw the districts to increase your party's chance of maintaining power? So there really is a slippery slope here in terms of the court not putting a brake on this. And I understand that there are different takes on should the court do it, or should we have an independent redistricting commission that's created by ballot initiative do this. I understand there are different perspectives on that, but the court really did, I think, miss an opportunity.
Let me take a call from Savannah, Georgia. Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing today?
Very well.
Two quick points I wanted to make. With the programmable machines, the problem with that is that I made a joke after the 2004 election that we brought these machines over to other areas, to other countries, to help their elections. In Afghanistan, when they were punching for Karzai, it still came up George Bush. So no, there's a problem with programmable machines and no paper trail.
Yeah, okay.
Secondly, the U.S. Constitution calls for, if a government becomes too tyrannical or too big that it's taken away the rights of the citizenry and it no longer is protecting that citizenry, that government should then be taken down, dismantled, and then start again.
But we do that by the ballot box in this country.
No, we don't. No, I'm talking about eliminate the government that we have currently, because the way it's working now is not working. It is nothing more than political corruption and cronyism.
So how would you do that exactly, if not by the ballot?
You cannot vote out the same different people. You take out Tom DeLay, so you'll put in some other party member, but the same party is in play.
Boy, so take down the whole government. Spencer, there's a radical solution, but you hear the frustration there, saying there's no way around this block in the road.
I certainly do, and I actually think that there are two things that we need to do, really. We need for average Americans to continue to be involved and to actually vote, to not get discouraged as a result of the current situation. At stealingdemocracy.com, if you're not registered to vote, you can register there. Also, if you've moved and you need to update your registration, you can do that at stealingdemocracy.com. We also need average Americans to work the polls and work on watchdog groups like the League of Women Voters, NAACP, Common Cause, election protection groups, work to preserve democracy in our own neighborhoods and communities. So that's what average Americans can do, but we also need some structural changes, and I think that your caller nods to that. We need to stop manipulation by politicians by renewing the Voting Rights Act, by auditing election offices and private vendors that supply these machines and other products and services. We also need independent commissions to draw districts and also to administer elections. So we need to stop manipulation. We also need to open up access to all citizens through Election Day registration, through restoring voting rights to former offenders who serve their time, through translated election materials like bilingual ballots here, through federal funds so that we can have enough machines and we don't have four-hour lines. And we also need to stop unnecessary barriers to voting that may exclude a large number of voters.
There's a big agenda. Jonathan Katz, you've been on this Caltech MIT voting technology project team looking at the technology. You feel people struggling with this sort of, you know, what's paranoid and what's prudent when it comes to suspicion of computer voting. Talk to us about that. Where are we headed? What about the quality of machines out there now? Do we need a paper trail to feel confident in this, or can they be programmed in such a way that Americans can feel really confident? And what about the machines that are out there now and headed out into the world?
I'd actually like to reiterate what Mr. Overton said. I think that the concern, we should clearly be concerned with electronic balloting, but we should be concerned with the entire electoral process. We lose a lot more ballots to inaccurate registration lists and people being purged. And who handles all the ballots? Who handles the Scantron ballots that we use in some jurisdictions? Mm-hmm. One needs to think about what are processes to ensure auditing of the outcomes so that average citizens and everyone concerned knows that feels confident in election outcomes. The topic du jour is on the electronic voting machines because they're programmable and the sort of ghost in the machine. But you know, paper trails aren't the be all end all to solve that problem. We've done my colleague Ted Selker at MIT from the project has done usability studies where you ask voters to verify their ballots either visually, and they, even when the machines intentionally makes errors, and so their paper ballot doesn't, their paper receipt doesn't match their electronic ballot, they don't, 9 times out of 10, they don't catch it.
So you guys at the Polytechnics look into the technology and say that's not the issue, that's not the problem, look at the bigger system?
I think that technology, we should clearly worry about that, but I do worry about there's many more issues to securing the integrity of an electoral process than just the machines. Like I said, there's as we saw in Florida, how do you design the ballot so that voters don't when they want to vote for a particular candidate aren't voting for the wrong one because there's a bad layout of the ballot.
Simple.
How do we ensure that absentee ballots don't miraculously show up, a day into the recount? How do we ensure that when ballots are returned, for example, in this last Ohio election? The polls are supposed to have an accounting. They got a certain number of ballots in the morning. They're supposed to have a certain number. Some were cast, some were spoiled, and some are not used. Those numbers should all add up. There were audit sheets that had numbers that didn't add up and then crossed out and just made to add up.
So no substitute for sort of policing the whole system here, not just the technology. Let me take a call from Lexington, Massachusetts. Jack's on the line. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Let me pull over here.
please do.
Question for you. Could you address, you touched on it just before the break, but could you address the lock that the Republicans and Democrats have on the electoral process? There seems to be no room, no chance for a third party to get in here. I'll take my answer off here.
Yeah, we've got it. And drive safely, Jack. Spencer Overton, how about it? I mean, talk about one party or the other having a lock. Between the two, it looks like a super lock. And at a time, I think, when a lot of Americans have got some disenchantment with both ends of the political spectrum here. What about the third party opportunity in our current electoral system?
I think that's right. And I think in a lot of states, Democrats and Republicans are guaranteed spots on the ballot. And other parties are not. Now, there's an argument that, well, we want to prevent confusion and we don't want 20 parties because there would be voter confusion. And frankly, I think the best way to deal with that argument is to take the a question out of the hands of the people who are interested in this question. I mean, right now, to a certain extent, we do have a duopoly over politics, and the parties that are entrenched and incumbents, the Democrats and Republicans, are making decisions as to how easy it is to get on the ballot. Obviously, they're self-interested, and maybe we need some other entity to make these decisions as to which party should appear on the ballot. One other just kind of quick point, Tom, that does have to do with entrenchment. You know, we started off the hour talking about renewal of the Voting Rights Act, and some people say, well, you know, race isn't a problem here anymore, that we've got some other issues. But, you know, if you look here at Killmichael, Mississippi, just in 2001, the population had grown to 52% African-American, and the all-white town council canceled the election just 3 weeks before Election Day, an example of incumbents who thought that they were going to lose to some African-American challengers and canceled the election. In Prairie View, Texas, in 2004, the district attorney threatened to arrest students at a historically black college for voting, and the county board reduced the polling hours there, close to the historically black college, from 17 hours down to 6 hours. Mm-hmm. Again, incumbents who were nervous that these African-American voters were going to cast ballots against them. The Voting Rights Act stops this racial manipulation by requiring that these areas show that their election changes are not discriminatory. The other provision that expires is the bilingual ballots provision, and that provision provides language assistance. And one important point here, Tom, is that this isn't an immigration issue. It gets confused with immigration, but in fact, 70% of the people who use translated election materials are born in the United States. I mean, people like American Indians who choose to respect their tribal language and heritage and live in a tribal community.
But you've got critics who say, if you want to vote, learn English. Come on.
Yeah, I think that that is understandable in terms of that argument, but translated election materials are needed for the same reason literacy tests are illegal. We want all citizens to have a say. Certainly literacy is a good skill, and English is a good skill, but we shouldn't dehumanize citizens by excluding them from our democracy simply because their language skills are not as strong. Why? Because the objective of voting is not necessarily to promote English or to promote literacy or to stop people from smoking. It's to ensure that we've got the will of all the citizens recorded, government of, by, and for the people. So we need to ensure that access is open to a variety of Americans.
Let me get one more call, if I may, here. William's calling from Stonington, Connecticut. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot on the table already, but I'm wondering if there's any chance of us ever having an Election Day holiday like most of the rest of the civilized world has.
And what would that do for our vote, in your mind, to your mind, William?
Well, I'm tired of senior citizens bragging about how they vote in such greater numbers than the rest of us. It seems to me like they're not working that day. Working people, especially working people with kids, face long lines, you know, at 5 and 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, you're saying, of course, you vote more than we do. You've got all day to do it. Working folks may not. Our time is short. Jonathan Katz, what about that? If we really could pull out the entire American electorate, without friction here, would that change the profile of the American voter in a dramatic way that you think might change American policy in a dramatic way?
I think that's much an open question. I think the literature has gone back and forth on it. It is clear that the caller is correct that a holiday would most likely cause an increase in turnout, and given how dismally low it is, that's probably a good thing for American democracy. Whether or not that would change the outcomes, given the system, that's unclear. But a holiday or other measures to make it easier for voters to register and to stay registered would most likely, as we've seen states that have gone, like Wisconsin, have gone to same-day registration. You get big boosts in turnout.
Spencer, we just got a minute here. Do you see, if everybody voted, would we have a different color voter, a different income level voter on average?
I think so, certainly. I mean, if you look at the existing data, Asian American and Latino citizens trail white and African American turnout by about 20 points. So certainly I think we would have some different turnout. But again, the objective can't be is the election going to be different? Are Democrats going to be advantaged or Republicans going to be advantaged? The objective here needs to be including voters. That needs to be the primary test here. And I just want to reiterate, citizen engagement is important. We can't rely on politicians to answer these questions. You can find a lot about a variety of organizations like the League of Women Voters and other organizations at stealingdemocracy.com.
Jack Beatty, do you feel the voters stepping up here? We've seen a lot in these last few years, and a bunch of it hasn't been pretty, yet this is really hard to get one's head around, to figure out how to address. Do you feel the revolution here?
No, and the problem is with this we, Spencer keeps saying we need, but there is no we. The we is divided. There's no Alan Greenspan here who can step in and say, here's what the rules should be. And practically everything he's mentioned are things that would go against the Republicans. And they don't want that to change. That's not a we. We don't have one voice on this.
And then there's the Democrats' history, too. But you call it like it is at the moment. Jack, great to have you with us this hour. Spencer Overton, author of Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression, thank you for joining us. And Jonathan Katz at the California Institute of Technology, thanks to all of you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.